Less than a minute, Raoul. Let the sound of the bell invite your attention to move into that still place within. It's as if you're traveling from the shore of your egoic mind to the shore of the no mind, the non-local mind, an awake, aware presence that we all share. It is the context from which all content arises. And we are choosing to consciously place our attention. And my teacher used to say, your attention is your most valuable possession. And so when the surface mind might be anxious and panicked and fearful and running away with a narrative, we can take that same attention and rest in the emptiness of being, in the freedom of the breath. Breath is another word for spirit. And so when we allow ourselves to identify as a spiritual being, then the human experience, which we all undergo, doesn't seem so roller coaster-esque. Yes, it can be ups and downs and rounds about, and you think you're going to get nauseated. But this is an opportunity to get off the roller coaster of the mind and the emotional body and to rest at the center of the merry-go-round where peace abides. And as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, the sound of the bell resonates with the mindfulness within the heart. And then the flowers of peace begin to grow within this heart space. There is a sense of love, the sound of love, that the soul can hear when we're no longer being driven by the tyranny of the egoic mind. Just hanging out in the silence can be such a great blessing. We have a sign in the classroom that a young lady made which says, "Silence is your perfume." If you are in relationship, and we are all in relationship, you can have a relationship. Charlotte brought her pet rock to me this morning with a sweet little face on it. And I realized that the silence and the peace of the rock were smiling back at me as I held the rock. Now, did the rock know something that I didn't know? Or was it possible that we could both meet in a resonating field of peace? I shared with Lady Jean that a swallowtail butterfly was following me around the garden this week. I would go to the pond to feed Napoleon, and the swallowtail was there at the pond. I would go into the side patio to do some work, and the swallowtail followed me to the side patio. And I would sit in a chair, and the swallowtail would land at my feet. And I found myself saying, "Is that you, Bert?" And then I thought, no, this is crazy again. So I'm just going to have a relationship with this peaceful little butterfly who seemed to want to hang out with me. And so as we get out of the mind that wants to figure everything out and we surrender and enter into that spacious place of the mystery of belonging, we realize that there are no accidents. That when Charlotte handed me her pet rock, that was not an accident, but an appointment with destiny. And everything in life is like that. When the anxiety should arise, instead of trying to get rid of anxiety, I have learned to invite it in. As a very young actor, I was invited to teach a bunch of young students drama. And there was a huge auditorium, and I was asked to go up on stage and speak to this large audience about what I was going to do. And the anxiety was so extreme, I thought I was going to throw up. But when I walked through that anxiety and up those steps and onto that stage, something came through. I have no clue what it was. But I realized it would not have come through had I not walked through that anxiety that showed itself so that I might move through it and not let it cripple me. And so I've learned to embrace everything that life brings us, to love the life that I've been given, and to love whatever arises, even if what arises sometimes has a sting to it. Then I'm no longer running away from life, but I'm embracing the bliss and the sadness, the pain and the relief, the contraction and the expansion. And there's an equanimity in all of that. And we're giving birth to a new life. And so we stop just long enough to remember the bell and how something as simple and as profound as the bell could take this jewel of our attention and place it in what Jesus would call the kingdom of heaven within. And he says, "Seek that first and everything is added unto you." He was using a metaphor. Find that beautiful still place within and know that that is home. And when we can allow that to be the operating center for all our doing, then we know that we are being at home in the one life, endlessly unfolding itself in new creative ways in the body of our experience. And it's very simple and yet very profound. So I invite you now to place your hand over your heart space. Take a deep breath within, give a sigh for the divine. And when you're ready to come into this playground of the unmanifest, open your eyes and look around at your own self, because there truly is only one life here. And look how beautiful it is in all its diversity. We have blondes and brunettes. We have ones with no hair at all. We have people with glasses, and we have a lot of masks. And each one is uniquely beautiful. And we get to bow to the sacred responsibility that each one of us is embodying on the planet at this time. You know, a friend of mine was sharing, she did a memorial service the other night where people felt their freedoms were being usurped by the request to wear a mask. And I just have to kind of shrug my shoulders at that, because when you know you're free, well, then you have to be free to take responsibility for the little chores. Like, if the neighbor is screaming at me about my dog digging a hole in the yard, I'm going to put up an electric fence to protect my little dog. And my little friend over here had the same scenario. We just came back from Maine last month, and Sweeney, the little dog of the north, they have a very large piece of land up there in Maine, and he came from Alabama. So he's kind of got a cracker mentality. And Sweeney thinks that he has to protect the whole mountain up there. Now, Lynn and Gregor had to put an electric fence down by the road, otherwise Sweeney would be running up the country road, chasing every truck and every motorcycle and everything. So Sweeney knows his limits. He runs down that hill, he stands at the corner, and he makes his statement, "Don't you mess with my family up here," and then he runs back up and sits on his porch and waits for the next squirrel, or the next possum, or the next deer, or whatever it is. Sometimes we get moose up in Maine. And Sweeney, he hasn't been diminished one iota. But you know what Sweeney loves more than anything? Is when his human pulls out the leash and said, "Let's have a special walk. We'll go to those taboo places where the humans go, and we'll let you off leash, and you can run down the cliffs to the water in the ocean, and the lichen is there, and Sweeney is free." So when I go up to Maine, I vicariously experience an expansion of my own life through a little dog that I wouldn't have had I not gone up there and stepped out of the familiar. So sometimes we step out of our familiar programming into the unknown to discover something that life is showing us. And this month I'm playing with the idea of our walk in the world. And what is your walk in the world going to be? You know, when you get to be as old as I am, you realize it's not what you thought it was. It's something so much different. It's how we interspirit. It's how we create community. You know, in Buddhism, they talk about the three refuges. And everything is a metaphor pointing to something else. So I reference these so that you maybe can take them within yourself and discover a truth that's organic and real for you. The first refuge is you take refuge in the Buddha, which is refuge in the emptiness, that place that I took you in that opening meditation. The awake, aware presence. Take refuge in that emptiness, that suchness of being. You could just hang out there and I wouldn't have to say a damn word, wouldn't I? Pretty nice. Ramana Maharshi said, all my teachings were transmitted through silence. That's refuge in the Buddha. Then he says, take refuge in the Dharma. The refuge in the Dharma is the teachings. You know, it's done unto you as you believe. It's the great teaching of Jesus. So if you're believing stinking thoughts, you might have a stinking experience. So then we get to take responsibility. What am I sowing in consciousness as an idea, as a thought, as a belief? Because all belief is causative. You know, I had a lady friend who said all men were jerks. And what do you think she attracted in her life? And I said, honey, once you change that belief, you'll start attracting different kinds of people. And I said, by the way, I'm a man. She said, you're not a real man. So that made me feel really good in that moment. Because you know what they say about you men. So be conscious. That's the Dharma, the refuge in the Dharma. And if you say life is so hard, life is so difficult, you know, chances are you're going to have a difficult, hard life. But if you can see life as this beautiful dance and unfoldment where we get to fall down and pick ourselves up, where we get to make mistakes, but those mistakes are sacred mistakes because then we get to choose again. And then life becomes this incredible adventure. My beloved Bubba Jake, who was the master of the bell, he can't do it anymore, so I've had to enlist Raul today. He left Tuesday morning in his little van. His dog Maisie was going crazy because she didn't want to be abandoned. And I said, you know, dogs like order in their lives. And when they see the suitcases out and they see everything in chaos, of course she's upset. And she was crying and throwing up. But when he pulled the U-Haul out in front of his house, where do you think Maisie sat? Right in the U-Haul. You're not leaving without me. And I said, now, Bubba Dick, this is your opportunity to have a committed relationship. You're 30 years old now. Let's start with Maisie. Well, they made it all the way through the hills and the flatlands of Nebraska, and they got there Thursday night, and I said, how's the little girl doing? And he says, she's better now because there's a chihuahua where they live. Now, Maisie has a friend that she can play with. So what if life gives you these opportunities to grow and change? And yes, there's some discomfort in that growth, but it's necessary. The last of the dharmas that the refugees in the Buddhist practice, and this is the most important according to Thich Nhat Hanh, is the refuge in the Sangha, which is the community. Because we need each other. We need each other to walk each other home, as Rumi would say. And who is there in your life to walk you home? Every time I come into the center now, I see Bert. I see him lying in the sofa in the classroom. I see him walking around the center,
you know, where would I go? You know, he's, you know, I haven't even been, it's been a month since I've left the planet, but you know,
every morning I go downstairs, I see him lying where he would lie every morning. Al knows that place well. Al had to stay at the house when we went up to Christmas in Maine, and I said, now the only problem is, Al, you're gonna have to sleep with a pug every night. And then he texts me back and he says, he hogs the bed, David. And I said, I know, but that's what pugs do. So he's still hogging the bed, but these relationships, the sangha isn't just the human sangha, it's the sangha of the garden. Sylvia knows what I'm talking about. That's your community too. Every morning I go out and there's Napoleon, he's the only fish I have left. He's a koi, and he goes like this. I said, hi, Napoleon.
Well, I've been waiting for you.
I said, I know, and I sprinkle some food and he eats. Now, also waiting for Napoleon is the hawk, who sits on the tree looking down at Napoleon. And I remember Gigi telling me about the herons eating her fish out of the pond. And so I just know that divine order is operating in the universe, and there's plenty of chipmunks for the hawk, and so he's leaving Napoleon alone for now. So our walk in the world, and this is what Ernest Holmes says in The Science of Mind, and I use this in every wedding ceremony. Ernest Holmes says, divine love brings together and maintains together those who belong together. And so when you know that divine love is operating and doing all of this, well, then you don't question it. You know, Trey and I were heading off to Turkey with Gigi, and I think this was on a Saturday, and we're leaving on a Wednesday, and I did a big wedding here at the center, and as I'm coming home from the wedding, Jody Rutenberg was doing one of her animal rescue things at PetSmart, and she said, oh, David, stop by PetSmart. There's a dog that's just like baby Speck. So I pull in, and Trey came to the wedding, he never does, and he had a glass of champagne, which I think is the reason things happen. And so in the cage that looked like baby Speck was this crazy wild dog, just like our female. But sitting right next to it was another cage,
and there was Bert.
And I said to Jody, is this one available? She said, well, my son Richard's thinking of taking him. I said, well, then he's not available? Oh, he's available if you want him. And then I said, well, but we're going to Turkey on Wednesday. We probably can't do it. And I know Jody. Oh, Al and I will take care of him, as we know. And I think he chewed up your house, didn't he? Pretty much. And so Trey comes, had the glass of champagne. He looked at those eyes. And we opened the thing, and Bert jumped in the back of the car, and that was history. Now, had we planned that? No. But were we open to the universe when it presented an opportunity? You see how divine love brings together and maintains together those who belong together? It was divine love that brought Gigi to me. It was divine love that brought Raul to a meditation class one night. It's divine love that brought them together. Who else would be in charge? So I think divine love brought Jackie all the way from California to experience a whole new brand of doing religious science. We're very different here. It's kind of the science of the heart. So yeah, everything is here for us. And so in this walk in the world, the first Sunday I talked about living with meaning, living with truth, and living with kindness. And this is all based on a simple little book by Mark Nepo, who's the next on your list to read, Mark. And when you live with meaning, that means you're living with soul, because the soul wants meaning in the same place that the ego wants answers, direction, and goals. Soul just wants some meaning in life. Living in truth, the truth is that which is within you. It's not something that someone tells you, because most of the world doesn't live in the world of truth. They live in the world of facts, they live in the world of belief systems, but the truth, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, is incontrovertible, and as the Greeks say, the truth unhides itself from within yourself. So when you begin to discover the truth, and it was Shakespeare who said, and above all else, to thine own self be true, then we get to ask that existential question, am I being true to me? Is this life that I'm living, is this religion that I'm embracing, is it really true to my soul? Or am I compromising myself to buy into a belief system that's based on sin and judgment and I don't know what else? I got a tickle again. That's what happens when you speak for a living. Limited idea. Don't think that. And the other idea of living is living in kindness. And it was His Holiness the Dalai Lama that said, my religion is kindness. He didn't say my religion is Buddhism. And so what would your religion be like? And religion comes from the Latin word religio, which means to tie you back to source. Just like yoga means to yoke you back to source. It was a sadguru that I studied with who said, you in the Western world should not be teaching yoga, because yoga is a spiritual practice. It's not an exercise regime. And so what you're doing in your Ashtanga yoga, or in your Kriya yoga, or in your Karma yoga, or in your Bhakti yoga, is you're connecting to that essence self, that true nature. And that's what religion is here to do. That's what yoga is here to do. And I would say that's what relationships are here to do. So living with kindness, living with truth, and living with meaning is how we started. Last week, I explored the idea, and these are all chapters in Mark Nepo's book, the idea of being wholehearted. And he said, someone who is wholehearted is someone who is not fragmented. A wholehearted person can be with their fear and their joy. A wholehearted person can be with the darkness and the light. A wholehearted person can be with our shadow side, which Carl Jung extolled. If you don't embrace that shadow side, well, then what we tend to do is project it out onto the world, and we blame and we point the finger. But you know that wonderful little metaphor, when you point the finger at others, three fingers are pointing back at you. So be careful what you point out there as what you perceive to be the problem, you know? And then you have a way of becoming a whole integrated being. You know, we were talking today about anxiety and depression and all kinds of stuff that arises. I've learned, largely through my friend Jeff Foster, that they come up to be met. They come up to be breathed through. They don't come up to be denied. After I had the heart attack, the grace that came out of that, I was 69 years old. I was going on a retreat with Jeff Foster. I'd been not even a month since the heart attack. And what I experienced at that retreat was all this unhealed stuff from my youth. Little 6-year-old David, 7-year-old David came up in a 69-year-old body. And I'm with a whole group of people that are strangers. And there was a lot of emotion that came up, little Ashley. And what did I want to do? I had so much anxiety, I wanted to run from the group. And I did that. I ran from the group. I ran out into the Colorado mountains, and I found a big old tree. I called him Grandfather Tree. And Grandfather Tree became I felt like he was holding me. Or maybe I was holding him. I'm not sure who was holding at that stage of the game. But when I had to leave Grandfather Tree, I wanted to pick up a branch, and I picked up the branch, and there were bugs in it. And I said, oh, that's your home. I can't take that. They were living in the branches at the bottom of the tree. But under Grandfather Tree was this big old rock. And I said, can I take this rock? And for the rest of that week, I held this rock. But then I realized at the end of the week, the rock was holding me. It's that we weren't separate. And so that was grace. And when that little boy came up, after all those years, Terry boy, of being exiled, and someone would come up to me and try to fix me and try to get rid of the little boy, saying, well, he's... The little boy in me said, I don't want to be gotten rid of. You finally let me back into your life after 60 years of exiling me into some place where you made me wrong. He was the magical one. He was the one that talked to butterflies. He was the one that could have relationships to rocks and trees. And so he says, don't shove me down into some place where I'm no longer embraced. So when he came in and how he lives in me, that's why you hear me talk so strangely about butterflies. That's my little boy who sees the magic in life. And he's not going anywhere soon. So that's being wholehearted. Now this week, the third week of this 5-Sunday month, is about what do we bring forth? What do we bring forth into the world? That's chapter 3. Now it was in the Gospel of Thomas, one of the logians of Jesus. You know, in the Gospel of Thomas, there's no hearsay. There's no virgin birth, there's no resurrection, there's no raising Lazarus from the dead, there's no turning the water into the wines, there's no miracles. There are just the sayings of the teacher. They're called logians. And you've heard me do the first logian. In your seeking, seek until you find, and when you find, you'll be greatly disturbed. And when you're greatly disturbed, you'll be filled with awe. And when you're filled with awe, you'll have dominion over your world. So it says, start discovering. And why you're disturbed is because, my God, this power, this presence was always there, but you were distracted by all your looking out in the world. And then when you realize how disturbing to know that this presence has taken up residence within me, you're filled with awe. You mean I have that kind of power to have dominion over my world with the very thoughts that I choose to cultivate and the place that I hang out? Could I hang out in the wholeness instead of the fragmentation? Could I hang out in the peace instead of the anxiety? And there's a conscious choice there. Now, the integration is, right in the middle of the anxiety is the peace. Right there in the middle of the depression is a deep rest of the one that isn't depressed. And you begin to integrate all of this. But the logian that I was going to reflect on, when what do you bring forth? Gospel of Thomas is harsh, these logians. Jesus says, if you bring forth that is within you, that which is within you, that which is within you will save you. He says, if you do not bring forth that which is within you, that which is within you will destroy you. Let those who have ears to hear, hear.
Well, that's kind of a strong statement, David.
Well, I didn't say it. It was Jesus that said that.
Well, what do you mean if I bring forth that?
Yeah, there is something inherent within each one of us. You can call it our Christed nature, the Buddha consciousness, the true self, whatever you want to call it, your soul, your jubilant and beholden soul. If you do everything, Rumi said, if you do everything and fail to liberate that which is within you, it's as if your life had no meaning. It's as if someone had given you a beautiful silver scabbard and you nailed it on the wall and hung a potholder on it. I'm making that up, but you get the idea. This is a sacred life that we've been given. What are we going to do with it? Little taste of Mark, what he says on this. He says, the sages and the philosophers, and he quotes Muhammad and Gandhi and Krishnamurti and Martin Luther King Jr. and Moses and Buddha and Jesus, and he says they all have an allegiance to this greater inheritance that they directly intuited from within. And you have that too. But you have to get still in order to discover what that is. And so he builds on that idea. He says, from that direct knowing, we can choose authentically what to bring forward because it genuinely speaks to us, being faithful to our own true inheritance. So what is true for you? I saw this thing on the news the other night about bees for veterans, and it was about men that suffered from PTSD in war, and they didn't know how to deal with their PTSD, but they've given beehives. And in tending the beehives, in that simple act, they were being healed. Now, what dynamic is taking place there? The bees, with their trauma and their buzzing and all the stuff that went on, awoke something that was nurturing in these men who'd been traumatized, and it's an amazing thing. So he goes on to say, will you build a bridge by which to cross the stream of your troubles in life? How are you going to build a bridge to face the depression, the anxiety, the troubles, the insanity on the planet? And he says, you got to do it through what you bring forth within you. And he likens it to the manna from heaven. Now he says, you know, in that myth, that story of Moses, they were provided manna from heaven when they went into the wilderness. Manna was those little biscuits that supposedly he ate. But he says, manna is that which nurtures you and feeds you during the time when you need to be spiritually fed, emotionally fed, whatever kind of fed. And he builds on this idea. He says, in order for this manna to arise and for this whatever it is to be revealed, he said, there must be a concern in your life. There must be a concern. There must be a need so that something is there to help meet that need. And then he goes on to build this idea. You can trust this. You can find a sense of wonder, a sense of care, and a sense of honesty in what arises. So how do you carry what is essentially true into your life? And how do you carry your own soul, your own pilot light, so that it might illumine all who touch and experience you? What will you feed your true self, and how will you care for your true self? What is manna in heaven for your soul? Hopefully coming here on Sunday morning is a little manna from heaven. I noticed for Sylvia and I, manna from heaven is working in the garden. When I tend the garden, it feeds my soul. Anytime I'm doing something nurturing to something else out, maybe that's what with the veterans and the bees, when they nurtured the bees nurtured them. And so he goes on to say, so how do you carry your one essential self through this world? And what is the food that you carry on the way that sustains your soul's journey? No one can answer this except yourself. We each must define what will sustain us inwardly and outwardly. Trey was running around the yard, and you know, my little husband, there was a book, a class I taught here called The Purpose of the Soul, and you were to take a test. So my husband took the test, I took the test. Turns out my soul is a motivator, creator type soul. His soul is a sustainer, motivator. And so he is more the god Vishnu, I'm more of the god Shiva. I change and create and change and create, death and birth, death and birth. He's a sustainer. So I read him that little paragraph. You have to find out what feeds your soul. And you know what he does for hours? He sits there and he hand weeds the moss garden. He tends that garden. He sustains it. On Sunday mornings, he stays home, Sylvia, and he mops the floor, and he washes the carpets, and he tends and cleans the bathrooms. And when he comes home, because he's a sustainer, he's the Vishnu. He takes care. He said, by the way, you need someone to help with the weeds out here. Don't make me come down there and weed the things up. He's a sustainer and a motivator. He's telling me what to do all the time, but I can't really stand that. So one last little bit here. This is what he says, manna from heaven. We carry a piece of the universe within us. It's like a little sun. And some call this our soul. And when we can be completely who we are, that piece of the universe that we carry within us, it emanates warmth and light in all directions without preference. You know, it's only the ego that has preference. The soul doesn't. Like the sun and the rain, God gives to the just and the unjust. So when you're in that radiant light, you don't care who's in front of you, you know? He says, manna, in all of its accumulated meanings, it represents this inner light that we need in order to survive and grow. Manna as the inner light within you that you need to survive and grow. And how do we personalize this inner light and eat and drink from it in our daily way? We got to make this stuff real. This is a very practical teaching. Jackie's been in this for 25 years. I can beat you on that one. It's 35 for me. But it's got to be personal. You know, Ernest Holmes was a pragmatic metaphysician. It's not enough to know that there's only one and we're that one. We have to then put the rubber to the road. How can I use that to live a skillful life? I'll call it skillful, where I'm not living in the problem, but I'm living in the solution. I'm living in the opportunity, in the possibility. You know, once you get to the other shore, obstacles don't exist. Obstacles become opportunities. Then you put up an electric fence and you smile at your neighbor and you do things that you wouldn't normally do because they're not obstacles anymore, they're opportunities. Now, living in Alabama, you know what an opportunity is. I'm just saying. So he goes on to say, we have to discern between being and doing. My beloved daughter, Terry, she's been a human doer, pushing her way through everything. And he says you have to find the fine line between the doer and being. And when you can let the doing come from this beingness, so who am I being in the moment? Am I being awake? Am I being peaceful? Charlotte just had a dear friend who made his transition. And when the news came, which was kind of shocking, she was being that beautiful resource of nurturing and knowing that the love never died. So it's who she was being that translated into what she was doing. And he says it's very important to find that balance for yourself. So that's Mark Nepo's take on what we bring forth. But my favorite authority on that one is Ralph Waldo Emerson. He wrote the essay Self-Reliance. I've taught this class on his essays many, many times. And my favorite of all his essays is the essay of the Oversoul. And in the Oversoul, he basically lays out what we are. What we are is the Oversoul, not the individualized souls. He said soul isn't just an organ of our body. He says there is one soul, it's the soul of the universe, and each of us is an aspect of that soul. It's like the rays of the sun. It's one sun, but we're rays of the one sun. And he calls, so here's how he uses it in his beautiful poetic language. He says, man is a stream whose source is hidden. Always our being is descending into us from we know not whence. Don't you love the way they spoke then? I desire and look up and put myself in an attitude of reception, but from some alien energy, the visions seem to come. There is this stream whose source is hidden. I know not from whence it comes, but it uses me. Could we be receptive? And then he goes on to say, that great nature in which we rest, as the earth lies in the soft arms of this atmosphere, there is a unity, that oversoul, within which every individual's particular being is contained and made one with all other. Huh. There's only one life here, and each one of us is an aspect of that. So he says, meantime, remember this is 1840-something, meantime within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and parcel is equally related in one eternal one. And he says, and this deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is all accessible to us is not only self-sufficing and perfect in every hour, that's why we focus on perfection in our treatment, it's perfect in every hour, but the act of seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object are one. That's quantum mechanics right there. How your perception changes what you experience. He was way ahead of his times. So he said, the soul in man is not an organ. It's not you are a body with a soul. You are an eternal soul, the oversoul, and within that there are all these bodies. It's the context for moving through the content. So Emerson was pointing to that. And he says, what we commonly call man, the eating, drinking, planting, counting man, does not, as we know him, represent himself, but rather misrepresents himself. Him we do not respect. But, he says, on the other hand, the soul, whose organ he is, would he let it appear through his action, we would make us fall to our knees. When it breathes through his intellect, it is genius. And when it breathes through his will, it is virtue. And when it flows through his affections, it is love. And the mind and the blindness of the intellect begins when it would be something of itself. God sighs to become known in us, as the great revelation of the One. Wow, so there is this something that wants to use us and to be the genius within us, to be the lover within us, to be the creative being within us. And it's always been seeking us out. Could we be humble enough to allow it to use this body? I've gotten to this place, Sylvie, the only prayer that I use now is, this life belongs to you, use it as you will. And then rest upon whatever that universal will would have this being be used, you know, through creativity, through intimacy, through hard work. You know, I love work. I love putting things in order. Order is the first law of the universe. But sometimes in order to get order, you have to have chaos. And we're in chaotic times right now. So could we embrace these chaotic times and find a semblance of order? It's so beautiful to see you all out there with your masks on. You look so respectful. My beloved Mark read a book in his car. It's a talking book. And it was a book that he was talking about in the revealing service called Falling in Love with Where You Are by my beloved Jeff Foster. And he is someone who embodies an individual who allowed this presence to use him. And it used him through the difficult times. He was filled with depression and anxiety and some of the darkest times, suicidal. But in meeting that, in not pushing that away, he found grace in that. And so he points to something, and I'll use this last little poem that he read as an invitation to go to our closing meditation. I'll ask Raul to return to the bell. And as I read to you, and Terry Boy, I entitled this, Who is Living This Life? Or rather, What is Living This Life? And he asks a series of questions to invite you to reflect on what it is that is always there, living your life, and when it's coming forth in you, can you feel into that? Here's how he puts it. He says, Who has been wearing these shoes? Who has been walking in these footsteps? Who eats this breakfast, speaks the words, breathes, and moves as I do? Who has known both the mountain of bliss and the valleys of disillusionment? Who has journeyed into the abyss and come out unbroken on the other side? Who has suffered both the joys of pain and the pains of ecstasy? Who has never abandoned me throughout nirvana, samsara, and those unspeakable realms of light? Who has taken the hand of my child and the unloved one, the frightened one, the dying one? Who is both the lover and the beloved and the imaginary gulf between them both? Who has called the entire universe in its arms? Who has cradled the entire universe in its arms? And who is closer than the most intimate sensation? You can just feel into that question. Who is closer than the most intimate sensation? Who asks these questions that cannot ever be answered and delights in asking them anyway? Whose music is it that I hear from dawn until dusk? Is it you who wears these shoes? Is it you who breathes these dying breaths? Is it you I return to? Is it you that I never left? Once in pursuit of you, I ran from you. I ran from those shoes and from the surfaces of things. I ran from all that I judged as mere appearance. I ran from the simple wonder of waking up in the morning to the fresh new day, not knowing what was to come. But now, I run no more. I can no longer seek or escape what I already am. I have been gutted, I've been turned inside out, I've been replaced by gratitude, and left not knowing why I ever doubted this miracle in the first place. What is experiencing this moment right now? Who am I, and what shall I bring forth? Raoul? Let the question move into your soul. And let the sound of the bell resonate deeply within your being. Feeling that stillness, we then learn to deeply listen. The very one asking the question is the one who is discovering that oftentimes there is no answer to the question. That the question itself is the answer. And so we live in the breath, and we live in the question, what is experiencing this moment right now? Is it the stillness within? Or is it the anxious one who's trying to escape the discomfort of the moment? We are the one witnessing that. We're no longer running away, as Jeff Foster said. And sometimes the one who falls apart, paradoxically, is the one who comes together in a whole newly configured way of being in the world. When the lost soul finally surrenders, it begins to discover that it was never lost to begin with. Somehow we have forgotten, misplaced, ignored the very thing that was waiting in the stillness, in the shadows, the little one, the fearful one, the one that was crying out to be held and to be seen. And so now we invite whatever it is that we've hidden in the recesses of our subjective mind to come out of hiding. That little one who wants to be held and seen for who he is. The jubilant and beholden soul that Emerson says lies stretched in smiling repose at the core of our being. Emerson has a simple formula that he gives us how we might reveal who we are. He says, be and not seem. He says, let us acquiesce. Let us get our bloated nothingness out of the way. And as we do so, we connect with the divine circuits. So the admonition is to simply be and not seem to be what you aren't. Just be. To acquiesce is to surrender, to accept what is, with a deep gratitude in the midst of whatever is, even if it's a painful what is. He says, get our bloated nothingness out of the way. Let go of the finite self that wails and suffers. Thank you for sharing. We hear you. But you're not operating. You're not in the driver's seat right now. And when we allow this reactionary part of our being to no longer drive our consciousness, we then connect with the divine circuits, circuits that have always been there, through lowly listening. It awakens within us the mystery of possibility and potential. And so we open to that. We don't have to have the answers. We can stay in the I don't know place and then stay fertile in a discovery process that's always filled with wonder and trust and creative inspiration. If there was ever the need for this creative inspiration to come forth on the planet, it is now. And so we open our hearts, our souls, our minds, our very beingness to this inherent, innate discovery of our divine inheritance. And we say, yes, this life belongs to you. Do with it as you will. I am here to be a servant of this truth, of this revelation. In Science of Mind, they teach a simple formula in prayer. And the formula is to recognize this presence, which is everywhere. The breath within the breath, you can start with that. And then to unite with that, to know that we are that presence. We are that emptiness. We are that amazing divine love. And then the realization step is to realize that if everyone is this presence, well then it has the potential and possibility to unveil itself and to reveal itself through the body of our experience as prosperity, as love, as all kinds of radiant health. And then once we realize that, we then give deep gratitude, because gratitude is the way we anchor it within the body of our experience. In all things, give thanks. And then like a gardener who plants the seeds in his garden, once we've planted these seeds of knowing within the soil of our being, we release, we let go, we trust that the God seed is growing within us, creating the God self that we all share. There is one life, that life is God's life, and that life is perfect, and that life is my life now. Say that with me. There is but one life, that life is God's life, that life is perfect, that life is my life now. Now feel that presence within you that is the one that knows no other. And if you would place your hands over your heart, and let's do the heart salutation as we say together, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
You are an aspect of myself.
The beloved within me
bows to the beloved within you.
In this spaciousness, we are one. So open your eyes, open your hearts, open your arms, reach up to heaven, stretch it out. Let's see the magnanimity of your being. Put it in your body. As a dancer, you gotta take it right down into the mirror of your soul and let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Wasn't that fun? And so it is. Thanks for sending in your ties out there. Masks up. Thank you for the coffee, Gigi. It was wonderful.